All right, now joining us for our last segment, and Ron is going to be the roadkill gentleman of the week, taking over Terry O'Neill's duties. We've got two guests coming in studio that will be talking about a very important subject matter. Events that are happening right now at some of the university campuses here in British Columbia. And I know we're also going to get into some other subject matters that we've covered before here on Roadkill Radio, involving student unions and what's happening on campuses, lawsuits, and all kinds of wonderful things. Things that we have never heard about coming from the pro-life and life groups before here in Canada. So the tide is turning, folks. I know that. I can feel it in this nation as I travel around speaking to people. I can see it in the young people that are starting to become involved, articulate, informed, but most importantly, the evidence. The evidence is overwhelming. It's indisputable. You can no longer argue on points of unknown or emotion. The facts speak for themselves. The other issue is we've had too many women who've had abortions, and we're going to touch on that subject matter tonight, a subject that we don't see talked about enough in the media, a reality that is part of this discussion, a reality, and I don't even like the word debate, and you'll hear me say that often, because to me, on issues involving abortion, there is no debate. It is ludicrous that we have come to this place in this nation. It is time to turn back the tide.
Stephen Harper doesn't like the idea of debate either, but that's another issue. Carrie Simpson here are Angela Steenstra and Alexander Myhill-Jones.
Yes, and on very short notice, I should tell our audience, I was working late last night. We had a different segment scheduled for today, and I got a notice that, Alexandra, you were involved in some very important work, Silent No More demonstrations or a campaign, an awareness campaign at the university. And it must have been around 9:30, 10 o'clock last night. I made an executive decision. I'm sorry, Ron, but I didn't call to consult you. I said, no, this subject matter needs to be talked about. So within a matter of overnight and early this morning, I started phoning Alexander quite early and call me quick. But this is important. And so I really appreciate the opportunity for you guys to be here to talk about your important work, your important stories, that the truth can be made known here in Canada. So welcome to Roadkill Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, first of all, this campaign is something I have just literally become aware of. When did you start? How does this movement become to the place that it is? I mean, there's momentum behind this now. I've had a delightful morning just doing the research, finding out what's happening both here in Canada and in the United States. And you two are leading forces in this movement.
For our leaders, for our readers, this campaign is called the Silent No More Awareness Campaign. And do you want to explain where that comes from? And
I'm the national coordinator for the Silent No More Awareness Campaign for Canada. The campaign was founded in the United States in 2003 as the result of work that Janet Morana and Georgette Forney had been doing with post-abortive women. And they realized that there are many men and women who are hurting after abortion, who experience psychological, relational, physical side effects that are often not talked about in the general public.
Well, and if you do talk about them, you're poo-pooed away and, oh, we don't want to hear that aspect. I mean, there's almost a bullying aspect to, you know, forcing silence around this this reality.
That's right. And as a result, they were able to gather together women who were ready to break the silence and share publicly their experience of abortion, their personal experience. And so the campaign is to raise awareness in the minds of the public that there are consequences after abortion. Yeah. We don't walk away from abortion, many of us. May not realize for many years that we're suffering because of the abortion, but we don't walk away without consequence, without it doing something to us on some level of our being.
And you speak from a very personal level when you talk like this.
That's correct. Yeah. I experienced abortion at the very young age of 15. Mm. And it was recommended to me after I became pregnant as a result of a date rape. Mm. And that, I can tell you, being exposed to my first sexual encounter through date rape was a horrible experience. But I can tell you that the trauma of experiencing an abortion far outweighs the trauma of date rape.
Now, who counseled you to have the abortion?
Well, I was working in a family restaurant. I became nauseous cooking bacon and eggs early in the morning, and my peers began to query me, you know, what's wrong, what's happened. I ended up sharing my story, and I was told, you know, Angelina, if you're going to do something about it, there isn't much time. Mm. I was not abortion-minded. I was very naive, really ignorant.
Well, at 15,
mm-hmm.
you're allowed to be.
Yes, that's right.
And easily persuaded.
Yes, and that's what happened. I was told that there was help available, there was abortion. And
you know, can I just stop you there? Because this is something that has concerned me for a long time, because we're probably very close in age. And this idea that pregnancy is a problem, mm-hmm. that's first and foremost sort of the culture thought on all pregnancies. You know, I think even, you know, when they're wanted, some people, well, you know, why? You know, but especially for a 15-year-old girl, the first assumption is that this is a negative.
That's right.
You know, and then we go from there.
Yes, and the negative is that you're young, you don't want to be pregnant, you want to finish school. There's this idea that you can't do both simultaneously, be a student and, you know, carry a child to term and even be a young mother. That was what was presented to me. It was like an and or, wasn't an and situation. It was a one or the other situation.
And it's all in short-term thinking. Nobody talked about the long-term consequences.
Correct.
So in all of this well-intentioned and good intention, I have every assumption that they were all very well-intentioned in their counsel. But nobody thought for a moment about what you would have to carry, the burden you would carry on with your life.
No.
There was no discussion on that.
Absolutely not. The day that I entered that abortion clinic, I signed a waiver saying nobody would be responsible for what would happen to me. I had no idea.
How convenient is that, hey?
Mm-hmm.
So you're 15, you go to the abortion clinic, you're surrounded by all these supportive people. Was there any counseling? I mean, we talk about the requirements of having informed consent. Was there any issue raised that you might have any negative occurrences as a result of this decision?
No. I was told that it was a very simple procedure. It wouldn't last very long, and my life would essentially return to the way it was before the abortion.
So fraud was involved in this then?
Essentially. Nobody talked to me about the development of the child. I was about 12 weeks gestation. Mm. And we didn't talk about the actual procedure. I went in quite blindly. And it wasn't until I was actually in the full abortion experience that I began to apprehend what was going on.
Something inside.
Yeah, inside. And my senses were involved. You know, I saw, I saw the bright lights. I saw the doctor in front of me. I heard the sound of the vacuum aspirator that he turned on. I felt the icy cold instruments inside my body. I felt the pain of the baby being dismembered.
Mm.
And, you know, I experienced the baby being vacuumed out of my womb with this high-pitched vacuum cleaner. And then I saw the remains of the baby in filling up, you know, in a glass jar next to my right foot. And, you know, that was trauma.
Mm.
You just had no, I had no idea that I would relive that event over and over through what we call abortion connectors, you know. Blood became an abortion connector, ice cold, the sound of a vacuum cleaner, sound of a dentist drill. doctors in white coats.
Abortion.
Any
connector.
One of these things would give you like a flashback.
A trigger.
Into that.
That's a right. trigger event.
That's right. Oh, an wow. emotional reaction. The weather.
Just what was ever familiar with that day. Is that?
Yes. And but you see, for years I didn't know that I was experiencing this reliving of the trauma. Because I was disconnected from the abortion. I didn't know that.
You were told that's how you were supposed to be, Angelina. I mean, this is a non-event.
Correct. Mm. So when I would become very angry, vacuuming, I didn't realize that, you know, it was
the sound
of the vacuum cleaner. The dentist. I avoided dentists for years until I couldn't anymore. And then when I would go to the dentist, I'd be all uptight, you know, and my palms would get all sweaty and my heart would start racing. And well, when I discovered this thing called post-abortion aftermath and I began to research it and begin to understand my own life experience, I learned how to cope.
How when did that, because this is talk about an evolutionary process, dare use that term, but this evolved. I mean, these incidences would become cumulative in a way. I mean, they must have built and built and built. How old were you when you started putting all these pieces together?
My first U-turn away from this self-destructive lifestyle that I entered into after the abortion was 7 years after the abortion. I was suicidal. Mm. I was enrolled in university at the time, and I really hit bottom. I'd been acting out this self-hatred that started the day of the abortion. And I'd really gone, my life was spinning out of control. Drugs, alcohol, serial sexual partners, and waking up, you know, looking in the mirror, hating myself even more for who I'd become. You know, where was that girl who I used to be before I entered that abortion center that day? And so I reached out for help. I went to the on-campus psych services looking for an appointment. And I had a lot of hope because I thought, well, they're the professionals. They're going to help me.
They're going to fix this.
I really thought that. And I remember going into the office and sitting in the chair, you know, quite far away from the therapist and gathering up my story, answering some questions. And then I remember I kind of snuck the word abortion out. And I said I had an abortion. And I think... really, I believed that he was going to say yes.
Aha.
I was expecting it to be an aha moment.
Because you knew intuitively, you knew deep down, you already had the answer. You just needed somebody to confirm what you already knew.
That's right.
And he was the professional.
That's right.
He should know.
Yes.
But no aha.
There was no aha. Hmm. And in fact, I just met complete silence. No response. There was no acknowledgement of what I had said. And I walked out of there knowing that I was not going to return. But my, you know, I just plummeted into this place of despair. And my suicidal ideation increased. I mean, this illusion that death could, you know, save me from my pain was simply that, an illusion. But, you know, it was so intense. You're looking for a way out. I was looking for a way out.
Well, it's still difficult for you to talk about, isn't it?
Oh, you know, is it difficult? Yes. You know, I've been experienced much healing, but it's not like abortion just goes away. You know, why not? Because you're talking about a death experience that I participated in.
You know, I want to ask you that because, you know, you talked about being suicidal. Did the value of life diminish? Because if you know, I mean, we all use these words around here, except for me, you know, sort of downplaying the cruel reality that abortion is killing a baby. In Canada, I'll give you an example and bear with me, our audience. You know, the avian flu scare came up, so the headlines in the paper said 60,000 turkeys to be put to sleep. You know, that's how we do things here in Canada. We don't really say we're going to murder 60,000 turkeys. Everybody knows it. So is it time to quit couching the words? Is it time to start speaking about reality, talking about the realities of all the implications that abortion bring. Our nation, when we are so willing to kill our own children, what does that do to the identity of our nation as a whole? All of those things, all of those factors are part and parcel to this discussion, and they can't be couched in nice little terms that let us sleep easy at night. You know, I mean, we're fooling ourselves on those fronts. So your suicidal ideations, were they, I mean, was it a way out, or did death just really wasn't a big deal anymore? Because if you can have an abortion and you know, end the life of a child, somehow your own existence doesn't have a value anymore.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I felt so devalued after the abortion. And, you know, how could anybody trust me? How could anybody think good of me or well of me? I couldn't do that for myself anymore. Mm. I walked out of there really a changed person.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and how do you get healed from that? How do you get restored from that?
Well, at 15, because you know that people took advantage of you. I mean, and this is where I think we need to start talking about the terms of fraud and all the rest of it and the legal implications that go with it. If we're going to do things, let's be honest about what we're doing. You know, and that honesty has been completely, you know, exempt from this discussion. That's one of the things that always amazes me, is our lack of willingness to embrace truth. You know, mm-hmm. if we're going to be willing to kill our unborn, let's say it. You know, let's be honest about it.
Well, in most of society, there is no discussion.
Well, yeah.
In our parliament, there
is. Well, in Roadkill Radio, there's discussion. Mm-hmm. And this is an important discussion that needs to be happening. So you go through a self-destructive terms for another 7 years or so. What turned the light? What was the turning point for you? What was your aha moment?
My aha moment was being rushed to emerge for an ultrasound, discovering that I was pregnant. I had been married now 7 years, mm-hmm. so it's 14 years after the abortion. I'm found out that I'm with child, but the baby's growing in the fallopian tube, and the fallopian tube, I learn, has ruptured. We don't know for sure if the baby is alive or dead. I'm 9 to 10 weeks pregnant. The baby didn't move into the womb, and it turns out that I'm in danger of losing my life because the tube has ruptured, and I've been bleeding internally for 3 days. So I'm told... again, I'm given a form to consent to surgery. And I sign the form. It's very early in the morning. I really haven't had a discussion about what's going on. It's an emergency. I sign the papers. I'm on my way down to OR. I get to the doors, and I suddenly have a flashback. And it's like, oh, my goodness, this is somehow feels like abortion to me. There's a baby. I'm going in for surgery, and when I come out of surgery, there's not going to be a baby anymore. And I just go, I can't do this. Stop. And it's like, I just need to talk about this. I need to process what's going on here. And the nurses actually were not paying attention to me. They were having a discussion about something between themselves and not really aware of the patient that they were wheeling down the hallway. And so, at great expense to myself, I bolted up in the stretcher, and I yelled out loud, stop. You know, that was very healing for me, because it's what I wanted to do. It's what I did when I was being date raped, and it's what I wanted to do on the abortionist table. And this time I said, stop.
You took control.
I took control. I reclaimed something inside. Well, they stopped. My doctor came alongside, and he said, Angelina, if you don't have this surgery, you're going to die. And I said, so be it. I would rather die than be responsible for the death of this baby. And he said, what's going on? And I said, well, I...
Sorry, but talk about processing information. you went into turbo speed, did you?
I did.
Yeah.
Exactly. It was like, baby, death, no.
no need to process any more information.
And the doctor said to me, you know, what's going on? And I said... And he'd been my GP for many years. I said, well, I've never told you this. It was my secret. I had an abortion when I was 15, and I can't do this. I can't go through with this surgery to save my life unless you can tell me that this baby has died. Well, I can't tell you that, he said. I can't guarantee you. Well, then I just turned my heart toward God.
Hmm.
There was nobody who could help me on earth. How could I say yes to this?
Hmm.
You know, it was just so much like abortion. And yes, I knew my life was at stake, but somehow my life didn't matter the same way this time. It wasn't all about me. It was really about this little baby who was our son, we later learned was a boy. And I just could not consent. So I received a real moment of grace. Just, you know, after an abortion, you know, we as one person said, we don't just depersonalize, we dehumanize.
Mm-hmm.
And so the baby was dehumanized the day of the abortion. So I never did ask the questions, you know, was it a boy, was it a girl? You know, as time went on, how old was that baby? You know, what would that child look like? What would that child go on to do, to become? I didn't ask all those questions because it was like it was a non-person. And so here I was, laying on this table, waiting to go into OR, trying to work it out. And I just asked the questions in my heart. Am I really pregnant? Is there really a baby? Does that make me a mother? And it was just like the answers were coming. Yes, you're a mother. Yes, there is a baby. Yes, yes. And then I said to myself and to God, I don't want to be responsible for the death of this child. And I just heard in my heart this, like, peaceful, in a peaceful sense, you're not responsible for the death of this child.
Mm.
This child I'm calling back to myself.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And there was a liberation in that moment.
Yeah.
And it was just totally opposite of the day of the abortion. And so in a sense, I relived and chose life, not death. And it was very healing.
That's one heck of an aha moment.
And that's how. And then from there, I began to, you know, it was legitimate. We were married. It was, you know, people were wondering, when will you have children? You know, what's going on? Is there a problem? And it was like, it was all I could do sometimes to tell people to just stop asking me questions. Because inside, I was afraid that my inability to conceive was connected to the abortion. And so this aha moment was, yes, there is a connection to my inability to conceive and to the abortion. And I discovered that I had contracted pelvic inflammatory disease after the abortion, acting out my self-hatred in these serial relations. They weren't even relationships, these serial encounters. I contracted an STD. And I then went back to the closet and opened it up and faced that skeleton. It happened when I was 19. So Joseph Michael Steenstra, the little one conceived who grew in the fallopian tube, could not move down into the womb because the tube was blocked by scar tissue. He died as a result, indirect, but direct, from the abortion.
Direct.
So it was, this aha moment kept happening for me because, so, Joseph Michael, we're grieving him. We've lost him. Yes, there is a connection to the abortion. We've named this child. Why is it okay to grieve this? Why is it okay to call him a person by name and grieve him? Then surely what happened when I was 15, it's the same.
Mm-hmm.
There was a person. Mm-hmm. That person has a name. That person, had that person lived, would be a certain age. And all these questions. So I asked the same questions of myself that I asked on that table the day that I was trying to find, you know, the peace inside to consent to the surgery that saved my life.
14 years is a long time
wait
for permission to grieve.
Yes, and it was a long time to be using all these other coping strategies, you know, to keep that beach ball of grief down.
If we call them coping strategies,
they weren't.
They think that you were robbed of so much, Angelina.
True.
I mean, you were 15 years of age. There were people who knew different. You know, this unwillingness to deceive people about the implications and consequences of abortion. you know, this is the truth that has to get out. This is, you know, a reality that we can't ignore. And I mean, through the work that both of you are involved in, you're not allowing it to be ignored. There has to be a large measure of healing, knowing when you speak to people or when you speak on shows like this, that your message is getting out. And that deception doesn't have a playground that it can thrive in anymore, because truth does expose the deceptions on these fronts. There has to be, and I know other women have come on board, and there is a whole speakers bureau now of women telling their stories.
Yes.
Now,
people, I've got a note from our technician here. We've had a caller phone in and say, we're talking to quietly, and they say the topic is serious and they really want to hear what we have to say. So if I can get you to get a little closer to the microphone and
all right, you want loud people, we'll give you loud.
Well, I mean, I understand that this is something that is not easy to talk. It's certainly not easy to talk loudly about.
Is it? I don't know if it's easy, but there's a mission attached to this, and that's gotta help a lot. I mean, you were taken advantage of. I mean, this is, you know, when you talked about when you finally stood up and said stop, you know, taking that control. There has to be a large measure of value to the good. For knowing you have a purpose, that this story has a value that will save women, that will save babies, that will change how people look at abortion. You know, I say within our wombs we give birth to nations, and in our arms those nations are nurtured. As women and as mothers, and what you have gone through, the deceptions that have colored the decisions of your life, there is such a thing as righteous anger, and righteous anger I really like. It's when that rises up and says, we're not going to be deceived anymore, I won't be silenced. Is this awareness campaign in large measure propelled by that?
I would say it's propelled by the desire to reach out to other men and women who are suffering as we've suffered. That is really one of our first, that is our first goal. Because abortion is, you know, really kept, the aftermath is kept hidden, at least in the public sphere. You know, the reason we share testimony on the street or in public gatherings as we did today at Capilano University is because we need to break through the walls that are holding us back from speaking our message. And we want to reach out first and foremost to those that know something inside but haven't had it validated. We want to say to men and women who have had an abortion, who are, you know, experiencing any kind of suffering, you're not alone. This is not abnormal. And you're not crazy.
Angelina, three times now you've mentioned men.
Men. You're reading my mind again.
And I just want you to elaborate, because we tend to think this is a woman's issue. There's the mother, there's the baby, but where there's a baby, there's a mother and a father.
That's right.
And sometimes the father, as when you were 15, is
a
different criminal, but sometimes it's a man who cares.
Yes, and sometimes it's a man who believes he's doing the right thing because he's bought into the notion that he should step back and leave the decision to the woman. Mm-hmm. And so he steps away from his natural instinct to protect, to provide, to preserve life. And let me just read a quote from one of our men who's been silent no more with the awareness campaign. And Scott said, "I didn't defend the life of my own daughter. Based on misinformation, selfishness, fear, shame, I let her die to an abortionist knife, and I died the same day."
Hmm. Oh.
You know, we're all affected.
So why the great cover-up? Why is this truth so beaten down? And you know, I say sometimes, you know, truth always will appear. Sometimes she'll wait for a really big stage, and you're giving truth a really big stage. And maybe that's where we need to be at this point. But what is the fear of letting this message out? Why is you know, when you sought help, you know, this is not new news. This is just silent news. You know, we don't want to deal with it. We can't acknowledge it. It may change how we have to look at the whole issue of abortion. Why the reluctance on behalf of the health care providers, dare I use that term, to acknowledge that these issues? I mean, we have issues around informed consent. You know, do you believe nowadays that this is part of that informed consent discussion?
Do I believe that we're having discussions about...
In abortion clinics, when young women, middle-aged women go for abortions, when they are required, the healthcare providers in those abortuaries, to give informed consent, is this part of that discussion?
I don't know that firsthand, but in that I haven't been to an abortion center to experience that, but I have been in post-abortion ministry for almost 20 years, and I can tell you that from the women that I've spoken mm-hmm. to and the men, it's very, very rare for a woman to say that she was shown spoken to about all that's going to happen to her possibly after an abortion. Like, I wouldn't say that informed consent is a common thing that happens. Like, they don't hear about what they may encounter afterwards.
What are some of the stories, and how do women find you? How is help given through the various organizations that you're both involved in?
Well, the Silent No More Awareness campaign, you can find us online, silentnomoreawareness.org, and it will link people to post-abortion ministry around the world. We are in 7 countries. The 1-800 number will link people to post-abortion ministry in their area. The website will educate people. There are many testimonies on the website. One of the things we offer is some information on how to tell your family, because in order to go public, you want to, you know, you just don't want to go public on air or on television or on the street without, you know, speaking to your immediate family and letting
of course,
them know
yeah.
what's happened in your life. I lost your question.
How do women find you? But now you've opened up a whole bunch of other questions, because this just doesn't affect the men and the women. I'm thinking of, because so many of my friends had abortions, and then what happens when they have a child, and then those children find out that there's a missing sibling. I mean, the effect of this one abortion just keeps going on and on and on.
That's right. My abortion was a secret for many years. And even after I lost our son, Joseph Michael, people still didn't know.
Now, your parents didn't know you were having an abortion?
No.
So at 15, you went in.
Wow.
I executed this with the help of some friends.
Hmm.
And my parents were not aware. And I was afraid. I was driven by fear.
Hmm.
And I kept it from just about everybody. So many years later, I'm having a very heated discussion with my father, and I blurt out, and if this hadn't happened, I probably never would have had an abortion. And my mother, standing in the doorway of the room where this is taking place, without skipping a beat, says, "So that's what's been wrong all these years."
She knew far more than the so-called professional did.
The mother's heart, huh?
Yeah.
The mother's intuition.
Well, she knew something. Yeah.
It's terribly wrong.
There had
wrong.
To be a trigger event. So how, when all this came out then, how did your family respond?
Well, we talked it over, and I mean, there was tears and there was healing. And then I began to receive invitations to share publicly. And so before I did that, I went to my mother's extended family and I told them what happened, and I asked for their forgiveness. This was their niece or nephew who died. You know, then as time went on, I had shared with all my brothers and sisters and asked for their forgiveness. And then a whole new ball game opened up for me. My nieces and nephews were becoming of age, and I had to speak to them as well. You know, this is your aunt who had a child who is your cousin.
Mm.
You know, it's like you said, and it goes on. And so not only have I grieved the loss of my first child, Sarah Elizabeth, and then our child, Joseph Michael Steenstra, but I've grieved the loss of their genealogy. Mm-hmm. I mean, this...
The tentacles just... Yeah. It's a mutated octopus that just keeps getting bigger and
exactly.
longer and touching lives. It's pervasive in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way it is. And the implications are such, and you know, I'm sitting here looking at Alexandra and beautiful young Alexandra, but how many of your friends, you know, don't have a brother or a sister because they bought into the abortion lie? And that's why I think the work that you're doing is so important. And let's talk a little bit about what happened out at Capilano today. How is the campaign met when you're on these universities and college campuses?
Well, generally it's met very well. Because Silent No More Awareness Campaign has a certain message which really reaches the campus environment in a different way. So what happened today at CAP went very well. The Silent No More speakers gave their testimonies and were able to speak with some passersby. And even though we don't always know immediately the impact that it'll have on people who are there, we know that seeds have been planted.
Mm.
And that later on, that may impact them. They may think of it if this issue comes up in their life or if they've already dealt with it.
Yeah. You know, I think you're sending a message that's so important. You're not allowing the deception to just be carried on without impediment. You know, if nothing else, it has to strike a chord of thought within people. We've had a lot of the different pro-life groups at the universities on Roadkill Radio. And I know on the phone I mentioned mm-hmm. to you, when they first started, I remember the gals from University of Victoria and, oh my goodness, the student union doesn't want us here and big brouhaha over funding and such. But a lot of progress is being made. People aren't backing down anymore. This story of truth is one that's going to have legs and be told. And loudly. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, one of the pro-life groups has initiated court action against Carleton University.
Yes, that's right.
So why, like, where is the universities of the 60s, you know, where free speech and radical ideas, regardless of how outlandish they were, you know, the universities were these bastions where you could go and have a platform. Why is this discussion so feared?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the highest percentage of abortions are performed on university-age women. 54% of all abortions are performed on women aged 18 to 29, so that's the university age mm-hmm. group. So obviously it's the age that's most affected by abortion. And no matter how you approach the subject, it's going to be controversial to some people in some way, no matter what angle you take. And so... what happened at Carleton was that they tried to basically show what abortion is using graphic images and were shut down for that due to the content of the display.
Yeah, they didn't turn their signs in. Was
no.
that? Yeah.
Yes.
That was the Genocide Awareness
somehow
Project.
Somehow the right. academic implication would be changed if the signs were turned inward. This is just the continuum of absurdity that revolves ad nauseum around this issue.
Yes.
I mean, it just... So they said, enough is enough. We want to be able to have our place on this university. We mm-hmm. want to be able to speak truth. We want to be able to show truth.
Yes, that's right.
And so where is that court process at this point?
It's still in the first stages. It's moving forward, but it's a long process.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you think part of the reluctance or the animosity that is generated over this discussion is because so many women who have had these abortions, so many of the men, there is this feeling internally that they can't deal with? You know, and I think when they're confronted with the graphic imagery, you know, somehow you have to put up this protective blindfold and say what I did was right.
Mm-hmm.
But then you come along with your message of it's okay. These feelings, these issues arise because you were lied to. You were deceived. You know, a fraud was committed not only upon you and your body, but upon your baby. is there not a license to say, wait a minute, let's revisit this? Is that maybe why your message is met with a little bit more of an embrace? I mean, nobody can argue with it, can they? This is your reality.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
But also by telling your story and the way you do, which is obviously still very personal, for someone else who has been through this experience, you offer them the opportunity of rehumanizing their own perceptions by allowing what really is, has been pushed down, like you say, trying to submerge a beach ball, by allowing that to come forth. You allow them to rehumanize their own feelings. That's a gift.
Well, you give license and legitimacy to those, because everybody's telling you, oh, it's a blob of flesh, it's nothing, you know. And so for I know from some of my friends' experiences, it's been this war within themselves. Okay, if it's just that and I could do this, then why do I feel this way?
Correct.
Yeah.
There is an internal war.
There is an internal war, and that's what brought me healing, was facing the truth honestly. You know, looking at an image of a baby who was not dismembered, and then looking at an image of a baby who was dismembered. Now, I don't grieve the same way when I look at the loss of Joseph. He wasn't dismembered. But when I look at an image of what Sarah would have looked like, yeah, that brings me to a place of grief that I needed to go to. This is really what happened. And that's facing it honestly. And facing something honestly is very liberating.
But in that grief, I mean, there are these factors, and this is what it brings out the righteous anger from my being. It's the lies and deceptions that are associated with this. If we're and, you know, our prime minister saying that this isn't a subject we're going to open up. Well, yeah, sure, Stephen. It's alive and well on Roadkill Radio. You know, this is a, you know, and quite honestly, that's so demeaning and degrading in itself when this kind of story needs to be told and our laws need to be reflective of these realities. And that's why I'm harping so much on Stephen Harper harping. Does that all work?
That'll work.
On informed consent. And, you know, what is the professional community doing now? Are women and men, and because there's got to be, you know, recognizable syndrome, you know, symptoms that go along with what men experience in this, is our whole mental health industry turning a blind eye to what should be, you know, a recognized syndrome?
I think you asked the question earlier, why are we not facing this? Why is this still going on? Well, I think it's because we're in denial. And I think we're in denial because if I say there's something wrong with abortion, then I am saying, I can be saying, there's something wrong with you. But if I can say there's something wrong with abortion, but there's not necessarily something wrong with you, where you can separate the action from the person. So you don't judge the person, but you judge the action. So I think that's part of the confusion.
But even judging the action, in your case, you're 15 years old. You are not responsible. Those individuals, those adults around you were responsible, Angelina. Women in crises, whether you're 22, 17, 39, 50, if you're contemplating abortion, you're in a crisis.
Correct.
There's just no ifs, buts, whos, it's about it. Women in crises or in need of help deserve to have the truth. They don't need to be taken advantage of. They don't need to be lied to. They don't need to have a fraud committed upon them because the issue happens to be abortion.
True, but if I say there's something wrong with abortion, we've had over 3 million abortions in this country and since 1969. One therapist suggests that for every single abortion, there's a ripple effect of touching 17 lives minimum. So if we do the math, then everyone in Canada knows somebody who's had an abortion. We just may not know, we know that that person is
had been participant in that.
Correct. Yeah. And so then in some way, we're all complicit.
Oh, for sure.
And we're holding it in place. And I think what's going on here is we're trying to hold something together. And if we start acknowledging that there really is something wrong with abortion, it's like this, the whole thing has to crumble. Everybody has to acknowledge their complicity. Complicity.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we look at the ugliness of abortion, it's like, how can we face that?
Yeah, how can we have been where we've been and say, oh my gosh, recognize it for what it really
is,
the horror that we've all participated in, and go, well, yeah, but isn't that better than continuing on with a
correct,
horror?
Correct.
I mean, sorry, I'm a solution kind of person.
I think that's why Silent No More Awareness Campaign is so important.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's the men and women who've been there and done that, who come forward, who've worked it out, who speak about it, who offer mercy, compassion, healing, they become, I think, a catalyst for other people's healing.
Will you pass on the legitimacy of what you have endured?
Yes.
And that you give license for people to be healed, because you
can't be healed unless
you understand where the problem is,
where the
pain originates from.
That's right. And I've seen it in my own family. Mm. You know, like when my mother's sister came and listened to me share my testimony, she wept. And what was she weeping for? For any way that she failed to be there for me, knowingly or unknowingly, as an elder. And so I think that...
Well, I go, my heart just breaks for your parents, because... If somebody took one of my daughters, I have three daughters and a son, and counseled them without involving me, I mean, they would be dead, you know, figuratively speaking, I think. You know, I mean, here in British Columbia, we have something called the Infants Act, where this does happen. Kids are taken from school. You know, because they can give consent down to 12 years of age.
Oh.
So we have young girls going for abortions because their school counselors, you know, that's the way you solve the problem. You know, receiving abortion, parents aren't even finding out about it.
Oh, that's horrible.
Sexually transmitted diseases, being given Gardasil vaccinations and all these different things, because, you know, the state doesn't want to have parents involved in these cases. I'm curious, if your parents had known, do you think the decisions would have been different?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents would have supported me. If I had just overcome fear and gone to them and trusted their love.
But it probably wasn't even fear, because I'm just, you know, I'm sketching this out in my head, the scene of you working, you know, in this restaurant, and, you know, the well-intentioned individuals, oh, you can't tell your parents, oh, my goodness, you know. All of these things, of course, the healthcare providers, your parents would be the last people they wanted to tango with. You know, and all of those people, and I mean, just off the top of your head, how many people would have been involved in that decision-making process?
The woman on the other end of the abortion, the telephone line at the abortion facility, she's the one who really sold me the abortion. She used my fears to draw me in.
Yeah.
And abortion is a big industry. I think
huge.
And that's the other part of, I think, the answer to the question is that abortion is an industry.
Yeah.
Many people profit from abortion. And so this woman has marketing skills to sell the abortion to me. And fear is what drew me in, because I was looking for a solution. And what was I afraid of? Well, I was afraid of my parents disappointing them. I was the oldest of many grandchildren. I was afraid of, you know, being ostracized in this small town. I was afraid of, you know, just that I couldn't be a mom.
And she capitalized on every one of those fears.
Yes, and said to me, it's very simple. You know, find some friends. They'll help you get the money. And you can go to many friends and gather up a few dollars from everybody, or just go to two friends. And so she knew how to draw me in. And then...
Well, and she enabled you. She gave you the tools accomplish this.
That's right. And then, you know, get them to drive you to Toronto. And then when we got to Toronto, it turned out it was an agency that was funneling girls across the border to New York State. It was legal in New York in 1972. This is many years ago. And so... And as a young girl, I mean, I was just... I don't know. I call it the... You know, the magical thinking of a child. oh, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Oh, we got stuck in traffic. Oh, good. You know, I've missed my appointment. And then we get there and it's like, oh my gosh, they're going to take me. Okay. So you walk and you just keep walking. And then all of a sudden it's like you're there. Fear.
Fear. One of the school districts here in the Lower Mainland, Planned Parenthood was trying to get into the school district. So I called up one of the abortion clinics here in the Lower Mainland and pretended to be a 14-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing that what you'd say exactly, the marketing techniques, the strategies that we're using. And, you know, I didn't even pretend to be pregnant. It was just, what if? Well, no problem when it happens, you know, because, of course, what 14-year-old who's sexually active isn't going to get pregnant or a sexually transmitted disease? Don't worry, you know, but I'll have to tell my parents. No, our doctors won't tell you, your parents. Every, you know, perceived fear and that she knew that a girl of 14 would have, every circumstance, every peer tactic was incorporated. It was amazing. So I've had that discussion. I know what that discussion is from an adult point of view. I can't imagine as a 15-year-old, you didn't stand a chance. I mean, that's beyond marketing tactics. That's just like, you know, the spider said to the fly, you know, come visit me, right? You know, and this is going on in one way or another. I mean, you don't even have to be 15. Again, I know some of the people that in my life that have had abortions, you know, they were in that state of confusion and fear. And this sounds like such a simple solution.
It does. It does sound like, because the illusion is that you can just go back to where you were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's not true.
Just like that. And you carry on with your life. Okay, we're fast running out of time. We will be doing this discussion again in other ways. You have more awareness campaigns, Silent No More awareness campaigns. You're hitting different universities. Where are you over the next few days?
Yes, on Thursday we're going to be visiting UBC, and Friday is at SFU.
Okay. Now, when you have these awareness campaigns, just give me an idea and our audience, you know, how do these work? Do you set up a speaker's podium, or how do people know what your message is?
Depends on the university. Yesterday at the University of Victoria, what we did was set up an information table, and we had pamphlets out, and Angelina and other speakers were there to give talks to different people who were passing by, and it was in a large open area of UVic, so a lot of people saw what was going on. And then later on, the speakers gave their testimonies to a crowd who were gathered in a large open area.
Okay, now, most importantly, funding, because this message has to get out. Getting a message out costs money.
Yes.
Can people donate on your website? Do you make it easy for everybody? Should they just send checks? You know?
Yes, to the National Campus Life Network.
Okay.
We are the ones who have been collecting funding through different organizations and individuals who support our work and Silent No More's work.
And you have an amazing website. I went there and I was so impressed. I mean, vibrant, informative, inviting. You're doing some really good work there. So what's the website address so people can find you easy?
It's www.ncln.ca.
Okay, and if you can't remember that, folks, just go to our homepage and you'll see it there with a link directly there. The time has flown. Is there anything else? I mean, I don't want you to get going on another story, because for one thing, my heart will break again. And I know that there's stories abundant in this.
I would like to leave our listeners with a couple of things. If you know anyone who regrets their abortion, go to Silent No More Awareness Campaign and register that regret. Join other men and women, either anonymously or by name, to register your regret. Also, you're welcome to submit your testimony to the Silent No More Awareness Campaign.
Important people. Yeah.
And also, just know that we're a campaign. We're not an organization. We have very visual signs. We hold signs, I regret my abortion, I regret lost fatherhood, or women do regret abortion, men do regret abortion. So we have a lot of campaign materials, and there's many ways to help us spread the campaign. So please visit silentnomoreawareness.org.
Can you tell me where you will be on the UBC campus?
Yes, we'll be
Thursday
on the North Plaza, the sub, North from Plaza. 11 till 2 p.m.
Okay. North Plaza from 11 to 2.
Yes.
And at Simon Fraser on Friday?
At the North Convocation Hall.
North Convocation Hall.
Yes.
Same hours?
Yes.
11
oh,
to 2.
Wait. Oh.
What's that?
You know what sound that is, ladies? That is the noise that tells us that we are about to induct two more people into the Roadkill Radio Warrior of the Week Hall of Fame. And congratulations. You both are in there.
Congratulations.
And we give that award to very special people who stand up for what's right, who have the courage to speak truth regardless of what obstacles they face, and that truly have a heart for making this nation a better place to live in. So,
and what better way to end this week's program? Thank you so much for coming.
Congratulations.
And good night.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay. It has been, that time has just flown by. So I really appreciate you girls coming. Thank you for the good work, really good work. And Ron Gray, we've got another big show next week. It just doesn't end.
Terry will be back.
I think, I don't know, he's in California, he may not come back. Yes, from what I hear, he'll be back, and okay. We're going to be talking about issues as they relate to the adoption of children. Are we sacrificing the best interest of children to facilitate political correctness in this country and in the United States? So we'll leave you with that, people. It'll be another good show next week. Thank you so much for joining us. Good night.
You've been listening to Roadkill Radio. Join us again next week for another trip down the superhighway of information, fact, and truth.